Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and one of the issues that we discuss quite frequently on this program is what has unfortunately come to be the war against natural medicine, and that actually is going to be the subject of an upcoming emergency summit at the Hoffman Center. That's going to be on February 26th, so those of you who are interested, please call the Hoffman Center for reservations, because we're going to go over all aspects of the current propaganda that threatens to bias the American public against natural products. Of course, it's not really working. The vast majority of you are really sticking to your guns, although it clearly might be causing some consternation to read lurid headlines that say supplements don't work, herbs are harmful and adulterated, so on. Today, we're going to talk to an expert. He's an award-winning journalist, editor, and consumer advocate with 20 years of experience in health and the natural products field. He is James Gormley, and his articles appeared in numerous consumer magazines and scientific journals. And he's really quite a scholar about this issue. He's thoroughly researched the history of natural medicine and alternatives in America. And he's written an excellent book that we're going to talk about today, Health at Gunpoint. And I wish you could see the cover of his book, because this is radio. But if you look at the cover, the gun barrel of a revolver is facing you at point-blank range on the cover of his book. And the subtitle is The FDA's Silent War Against Health Freedom. So without further ado, here's James Gormley. James, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. It's a real honor to be on your program.
So your book starts out by tracing, providing us with a historical perspective, tracing the history of natural medicine in America. And it's been a contentious history. It's not as if the current battles that are being waged between orthodox medicine and alternatives are brand new. So give us a little bit of context historically.
Sure. Well, you know, sometimes I think many of us, and myself included, way back when, used to have this viewpoint or this sort of idea that in the old days everything was pure and unadulterated, and to a certain extent some of those points are true, to the extent that we didn't have synthetic chemicals until the late 1800s, beginning early 1900s. However, the reality is that in the 1800s in the U.S., the nation was a filthy, dirty, and dangerous place. In terms of our food supply, in terms of chemicals that were used on crops, such as arsenic or cyanide, plus there were patent medicines that were very dangerous and very popular that had mercury, laudanum, opium, other uncontrolled substances, and the cities, which began to develop, became cesspools of disease and decay. So it was not a sort of halcyon sort of wonderland of you know, pure living. It was a time when, especially in the late 1800s, when agriculture began to strip wheat to produce white flour, that our food supply and our public health situation really came to a crossroads.
So we have this sort of idyllic view of life as it once was, but actually there were a lot of poisons. There was a lot of toxicity. Also in the field of medicine, some of the medical procedures that were used, I mean, we talk about the harmful effects of radiation, chemotherapy, drug side effects these days. But some of the medications that were around in the 19th century were literally blood-curdling.
That's true. It was what was accurately described as a heroic medicine. I guess we would probably describe it today as barbaric medicine, but clearly things like bloodletting and things of that nature were often led to the patient dying before we could determine whether it helped.
Right. Then, so we actually may have expedited the course of nature.
That's correct.
So into this context came actually my understanding of it is that a reform movement arose, which is actually the basis of modern alternative medicine, which is an effort to get away from giving people mercury and bloodletting and toxic enemas and the like, to kind of go back to our natural healing roots.
That's correct. There were holy American systems really emerged. One which was greatly influenced by Native American tradition was called Thompsonianism, and that was started by Samuel Thompson, who was a New Hampshire farmer, and he developed this herbal healing-based system of trying to restore, the body's heat. And that system of medicine was very popular in the 1820s and 30s. The Reform Medical College was established by Worcester Beach at the end of the 1820s. That was another system, eclectic medicine, which was very popular for decades. And that had Native American roots as well. And then there were religious-oriented groups that were focused on temperance and health. You could think of the Shakers, Millerites, Seventh-day Adventists, and others that really developed and were very health conscious and, again, focusing on temperance, clean living, clean water, and the like. And I won't give you a whole litany of all of them, but certainly osteopathy, Andrew Taylor Still was important.
The DOs now, modern, what are now, they're MDs, and then there's another school of medicine, which is the DO school of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely correct. And I'm in chiropractic, which was founded really just a few years after that by Daniel Palmer. And then, there was European influences, too. Of course, Benedict Lust, he came over, brought over some of the, went back to Germany, brought over some of the, hydropathy and some of the European tradition over here. And even he opened a health resort in New Jersey in 1900, actually, that was very popular. In addition to that, we had the physical culture movement, people like Bernard McFadden, Charles Atlas, Jack LaLanne. That was an important factor as well, which really led to the first health food stores opening anywhere from around, 1896 to 1938.
Hmm. And, of course, you mentioned in the book my radio predecessor, Dr. Carlton Fredericks, who reined the airwaves from the 1940s until the 1970s.
That's absolutely correct. He was certainly a very important voice in both informing the public and popularizing what would later become enlightened medicine.
So clearly, at a certain point, there was a backlash by conventional doctors because they saw these emerging movements and they sought to suppress them.
Yes, that's correct. It first of all, you have people looking at the food supply part of the equation before we get to the medicine part, like Harvey Wiley, for example. He was the first head of the FDA. And he really
which is a good thing, because it was actually in the wake of the book by Upton Sinclair, The Jungle, that pointed out all the horrible abuses in the meat business.
That's absolutely correct. Even though I guess Upton would have preferred that his message of promoting communism had taken a stronger root, which was his intention, side point of using the food supply as an example of you know, capitalist lack of ethics led to many improvements, as you point out, which we're the beneficiaries of many of those reforms today, which is good. And as I mentioned, Harvey Wiley at the FDA, who started there around the 1880s, he really was the father of the first what's called the Pure Food and Drug Acts of Act of 1906, which was a very important piece of legislation and regulations that came from that really provide a lot of protections for consumers. But unfortunately, he clashed with the powers that be and the other commissioners, and even President Roosevelt, because President Roosevelt liked saccharin in his tea. So he, unfortunately, Harvey Wiley didn't sit well too well with the the emerging leadership of the USDA and later of the FDA. So he wound up going over to the Good Housekeeping Institute in 1912, and he was there for many years. But in terms of medicine, you had mentioned about that. It's interestingly enough, what we today call alternative medicine was mainstream medicine until the early 1900s. That's when there was a report issued at that time, the Flexner Report. It was a report that was commissioned by Congress, and I believe they asked Harvard to do it. But it was a report that was very biased, but it was very inaccurate, but nonetheless was very damning of alternative medical schools, and it wound up leading to the closure. Basically, most of alternative medicine was run out of town in the early 1900s, with the exception of a couple of osteopathic schools, with a couple of other exceptions. So that's quite unfortunate.
Yeah, and ironically, this is the byproduct, as you say, of the progressive movement, of a movement towards reform, with inadvertent effects and a chilling effect on the practice of medicine.
That's correct, and I guess that's a very good point. I think the only side influence to that, though, which sort of clouds the progressiveness of it, was the fact that the fledgling non-apothecary pharmacies and the then fledgling American Medical Association, they were a couple of groups that really pushed for they really wanted to have a very damning report which could take out the competition, and unfortunately it worked.
Well, could we actually apply the word monopoly to this phenomenon of mainstream medicine achieving preeminence and the pharmaceutical industry growing enormously? I mean, we go back just 100 years, 1914, this is just the beginning of the fledgling pharmaceutical industry. There were a few patent drugs in those days, a handful of them. And now, 2014, drugs are proliferating. The drug industry is a multi-billion dollar worldwide, conglomerate. Mm-hmm. And, what has led to this?
Yeah, that's a very good point. Some people use the word monopoly, which is accurate, cornering the market, if you will. Some people even use the word conspiracy. I hesitate to use it, because often that word is misinterpreted and sometimes is used by people who are not very well informed and applied. However, really all a conspiracy is a confluence of forces, whether they be economic, political, powerful forces that are complementary to each other and or synergistic and lead to certain ends. And that is the case with we see that with Big Pharma. It's very cozy relationship with the FDA. If you look at the fact that the last budget increase of the FDA, 40% of that budget increase was made up of user fees from prescription drugs.
So it's a pay-to-play system, in effect.
Exactly.
And they have the ability to levy fees on the very industries that they regulate. It reminds me a little bit of what happened, I guess it was in the 1700s, when the British wanted to achieve dominance on the seas, and they granted licenses to pirates. But they called the pirates privateers, and they said, you have a license, you can raid and you can accumulate as much booty as you want from your hapless victims, as long as they don't fly the Union Jack and that they're the enemies of the British Commonwealth, and in effect will be executing public policy, and at the same time you can enrich your own coffers.
That's correct. That's a very colorful and an excellent example. We have an exact corollary of that today, an exact corollary of those warrants or those, you know, license to pirate approvals. Today we have patent drugs, whether you call it a patent or a warrant or, you know, license. We have patent drugs which... And the cop that enforces that is the FDA, the agency that receives anywhere from, 500 million to maybe 700 million, or that the cost associated with you know, developing an approved drug can be as high as that. And you have the FDA providing and enforcing a monopoly for each one of those patented drugs that are out there, and if that's not it's an enforced and a guarded monopoly. That's really a regulated or quote unquote a legal collusion between the FDA and the regulated industry. In this case, Big Pharma.
And as you know, there's a big push for the FDA to quote. Regulate or take control of the supplement industry, because it's now widely claimed, and the allies of the regulators in the press and the media continually repeat this mantra: the supplement industry is a vast unregulated free fire zone, and it must be brought to heel by regulators in the Food and Drug Administration. But wouldn't that increase the purview of the FDA, thus increasing its power, its fee base, ultimately drive a lot of the supplement industry to go under the aegis of the current pharmaceutical industry?
It very much would. And the ridiculous part of the story, or the sad part of that whole argument on the part of the FDA. The FDA has more than sufficient power right now, even as of 1994, to very robustly regulate, to oversee and to surveil, regulate and enforce the dietary supplement industry. Several FDA commissioners have testified in their confirmation hearings they were asked, does the FDA have sufficient authority to properly and efficiently regulate the dietary supplement industry? And each one of those commissioners, over the last several commissioners, have all stated that, yes, the agency has more than sufficient power to properly do what it needs to do in reference to dietary supplements. But meanwhile, aside from what the commissioners are saying, the agency itself is always bemoaning lack of resources, while at the same time it's always asking for more power, trying to take more power unto itself. And there's a very well-known constitutional scholar, Jonathan Emord.
Who has been a frequent guest here on Intelligent Medicine. He's well known to us. Yeah.
He is well known to your audience and just to anyone studying these issues. And he has made it very clear, abundantly clear, that the FDA is an out-of-control agency with really no true checks and balances. You would think that the budget appropriations process is the only check and balance that there is, but that usually is just a blank check that is pretty much handed to the handed to the agency.
As we just saw in the current, raising the budget ceiling, it's
correct.
An act. It's almost an act of heresy to cut funding for any kind of federal program. We keep perpetuating this, the current status quo. But, you mentioned the regulations. There's a law, and you mentioned 1994, and that happens to be the year that the current regulations were passed. They're called DSHE, the Dietary Supplement Health Education Act. And explain what the current framework is. And there are some upsides and some downsides, and you discuss that in the book.
Yeah, that's correct. So the main law, for want of a better term, the main law governing our access to and right to purchase dietary supplements is that law you referenced, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, often referred to as DSHE. And that is, while it is an imperfect law, it provides more than sufficient controls and protections for consumers. It provides a whole raft of different safety and oversight provisions, and including good manufacturing practices, including the review of safety procedures at manufacturing facilities, including the labels on bottles of products that people buy, and various other submissions that that companies need to make. So while it is not perfect, it is far superior to the regulations that are over supplements in, say, Canada or in most countries in the European Union.
We're going to get to that in a minute.
Sorry.
Because I think, it's okay. But one of the main contentions of your book, Health at Gunpoint, is that storm clouds are looming on the horizon for American natural products consumers and natural medicine consumers. Because actually part of the pitch for your book, and it's on the cover of the book, is a startling look at the health restrictions to come. But before we get to that part of the story, one of the drawbacks of the DSHE that I think is a very serious drawback is that it makes it impossible for supplement companies and responsible spokespersons to communicate the health benefits of supplements to consumers. So, for example, we develop something like... let's take a recent example. High-dose vitamin D has been shown to help multiple sclerosis, not just prevent it, but actually its studies support its use in the treatment of multiple sclerosis. However, if we took a bottle of 5,000 international unit vitamin D and we labeled it, multiple sclerosis aid, that product would be immediately seized by the Food and Drug Administration. The warehouse would be raided. The products would be confiscated. Warning letters would go out. Fines would be levied because it's a disease claim. We could call that product immune support. We could use sort of weasel words to provide a connotation that there's some health benefit, but without mentioning a specific disease. Can you comment on that?
Yes, the restrictions that are around supplements, say they're called referred to as a structure function claims, or the structure function provision. And I'm just switching to my other phone.
Okay.
The structure function provision, which allows companies to say, very vague statements, as you mentioned. So, like, this product may help support a healthy, stomach. that's not a good example. A healthy gastrointestinal process. And you're, well, gee, does this help with constipation? Does it help with diarrhea? You're not really, one isn't really clear. So, unfortunately, the information that is on bottles is very vague and very nonspecific.
Yeah, it's almost like a secret code that we have to use to communicate with consumers, you know, as if we were in some kind of foreign occupied country and we didn't want the secret police to understand, get upset by our communication. So it's like the messages that were broadcast by the French resistance, to one another, you know, that sounded like meaningless messages, but they held meaning for the recipient of the message.
Yeah, you would think there would be some sort of provision that allows the manufacturer to do wink or nod at the consumer, because otherwise there wouldn't be enough. There's not enough information to really make a fully informed decision as to what the product is for. So that is certainly an important drawback. However, that being said, the fact that we do currently have high potency supplements, that's assuming that the U.S. doesn't fully head down the path of trade harmonization with the regulations of other countries.
Okay, so that's an interesting word, harmonization. You know, for a lot of people, like, you know, it sounds like a musical term. You know, we're going to sing, and harmonization actually has kind of a sinister connotation when it comes to supplements. So why don't you explain that concept in detail?
Sure. So, many people are worried, and certainly there's been some histrionics regarding this as well among some of the the sky is falling contingent, let's say. But I will say, though, that there are concerns that the U.S., which is a signatory to the World Trade Organization, and obviously we're members of the World Health Assembly, the World Health Organization, and obviously the United Nations. So all of those bodies, aside from the WTO, all of those bodies are connected. So
sounds a little like a world government body.
Well, yeah, it
we're moving more towards that model.
We are, and you know, I know people would sometimes say New World Order, and you know, the idea sometimes seems very, very scary.
It's like the black helicopters.
That's right. So not to get too far down the road of Prison Planet, I will say that there are some real concerns about, we should have real concerns about where the U.S. Could be headed, really depending on who is heading up its delegation to the World Health Organization, specifically the Codex Alimentarius Commission, which is a food safety oversight body that promotes trade and supposedly promotes the safety of foods that are traded internationally. So that's one area of concern, which probably would be food for a whole program in and of itself.
But it
relates to the whole question of harmonization, because the U.S., certain officials at the U.S. have already stated that they intend to, that our nation head down the path of harmonization, of basically aligning our a relatively robust dietary supplement regulations, which allow, or I should say relatively liberal regulations, dumbing them down, or bastardizing them, if you will, to be more in compliance with the weak dietary supplement potencies and ingredients that are allowed in other countries.
Yeah, that is the EU, the European Union.
Yes.
And so give us an idea. I haven't been over there in a while, and I'm not really in touch with the situation over there. But from what my general impression is that they're pretty good with herbs. that they have, they're really into herbal medicine. They have really some very fine quality herbal medicines. In fact, some of the products that we get in this country were pioneered in Europe and are very popular and are used as, you know, they're really extremely well utilized by the European population. I'm thinking of St. John's wort as an example. Mm-hmm. It's used by many people for depression. I'm also thinking of a product called VenoCare, which is a product that is used for vein problem, foot and leg swelling. It's a horse chestnut extract, but it's highly standardized and very carefully inspected and manufactured, I think, in Austria. And so they have access to that. But when it comes to vitamins and supplements, the ceilings are very low. So it's very hard to get high potency vitamins and supplements there. So what's the situation? Tell me about that.
Well, it's you described it very well in a nutshell, or in a chestnut. But no, it really is interesting that the European herbalism or the European herbal tradition, that kind of continued on unabated. So you do find a very vibrant herbal community in Europe, and a good knowledge base among practitioners and among consumers over there as to the benefits of herbal medicine and teas. And in fact, Germany, of course, came out with its huge Commission E monograph.
Yeah, they do a good job.
They did a great job, describing the scientific basis of the benefits of hundreds and hundreds, perhaps it's thousands, of herbs. So that's all good. Unfortunately, it's reverse of the United States in terms of vitamins and minerals. And I think my suspicion is that it's, for some reason, the dispensing of and production of vitamins and minerals and other dietary supplements in Europe is completely pharmaceuticalized.
No.
You really find that the large pharmaceutical, many of them are in Switzerland or Germany, etc., you'll find that they are the ones who produce most of the dietary supplement products that are at least the ones that come out of Europe for internal consumption. So that model has become very, the pharmaceutical industry, if we think it's powerful here, it's even more dominant there, and especially in terms of dietary supplements. So
the consequence is that there's less diversity in terms of the supplements you can get. There's lower potency. I think vitamin C is limited up to a very low level. I'm not quite sure what that threshold
is. Maybe 50 milligrams or something like
that. Wow. Okay.
Which is an infinitesimal amount, just in terms of if you're looking for to help your immunity to prevent colds.
Just enough to help avert scurvy, just about.
Right, scurvy, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And so
that's where Europe is. It does allow disease, disease reduction, levels. So you can avoid beriberi and scurvy and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about it. There's not much more to it than that in terms of what's available in Europe.
So in your book, Health at Gunpoint, you actually go over the situation pretty extensively in Canada as a cautionary tale for the United States, because we say it can't happen here, but it's happening across the border, our northern border. Our neighbors to the north are adopting more and more stringent rules in, quote, harmonization with Europe, to pretty deleterious effects for the consumer.
That's correct. And just so I don't, so I can avoid antagonizing our Canadian listeners, I will start out by disclosing that I'm from Canada originally. So I definitely bear a great deal of affection for the United States and for our northern neighbor. So that being said, unfortunately, the Canadian people have had to endure really since the 2000s, they've had to endure an amazing level of reduction in the number of products that are available in Canada. I would say 40,000 plus products have disappeared from store shelves in Canada as a result of the very, very restrictive Health Canada regulations concerning dietary supplements.
And I have real concerns because there are a lot of people in health planning and health policy in America who have tremendous admiration for the Canadian system. They say we really point to the fact that that people there's less inequality in Canada, that people have better access to health care, although wait times may be longer, although certain procedures may be harder to obtain. That it's more equitable, and that the vast majority of Canadians are fine with it. So maybe they're saying, "Hey, let's emulate Canada, and let's also emulate their supplement regulations."
Yeah, one might think that, in other words, in terms of where our current healthcare system seems to be headed, vis-a-vis Obamacare. Et cetera, seems to be headed partly in that direction, if in a flawed, arguably flawed pathway. But I think there are some benefits to that system, but unfortunately, Canada, which really started out with a very strong tradition of Native American, which they call, in Canada, call Aboriginal medicine up there in Canada, there was really some widespread acceptance in the early days, which really didn't take too long, unfortunately, to turn to, really, really difficult restrictions. So that's what Canadians are dealing with today.
Well, there's one type of herbal medicine that they seem to favor in Canada, particularly in the western provinces, which is marijuana. So you can get you can buy pot legally and consume it openly. And in Vancouver, you can get hypodermic needles. So I guess there's an opening up of sorts to some forms of, quote, natural medicines. But, for example, my understanding, when I talk to my Canadian patients, is they can't get certain things. They can't get DHEA. They can't get melatonin anymore. Is that correct? Melatonin is not available over the counter?
I believe that's correct. I don't want to misspeak, but I believe your statement is correct.
Okay, so which is a tremendous sleep aid with very little in the way of potential downsides. Other supplements are now becoming less accessible. Can you think of any others that are problematic?
Well, I have to look at my list of 40,000 supplements. I have to dig up that box. But I can't think of specifics right now, but it's just really the majority of products in health food stores, majority of dietary supplements that came from from outside the Canadian border, have been stripped of store shelves, mainly because of the potencies of the ingredients in those products, but in some cases because of the ingredients themselves, as you mentioned.
Well, one of the themes of this program is we're called upon time and time, especially in the last few months, to do damage control on studies that claim that vitamins are worthless, vitamins are harmful in some instances, that herbs are adulterated or you're not getting the value with the vast majority of herbs that you buy. And the statement is often appearing in prominent newspapers like the New York Times especially, but the Wall Street Journal, Newsday, various national publications, is that the industry is unregulated. There's all kinds of deleterious effects. Lots of people getting sick. And do you think that there's a concerted campaign where the media is complicit in creating an atmosphere where the public will be accepting of more restrictive legislation ultimately?
I don't think that it's a conscious conspiracy or collusion.
Okay.
I think it's really just the fact that negative news sells.
Yeah, okay.
Negative is sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, it attracts more attention. It leads to greater readership, more Facebook likes and tweets and advertising dollars, because you know, advertisers will spend more money with newspapers or TV programs that seem to have a more active or broader audience. So I think those are the factors. It is very disappointing as a journalist myself, an author. It's very disconcerting for me that that it's so pervasive, though, in terms of the whole Wild West sort of motif, which is couldn't be further from the truth, because you know there have been scholars of the regulations. I can think of one scholar, Peter Barton Hutt, who is probably the country's leading expert on dietary supplement regulations and all, you know, in the history of regulations, and also the real world, you know, being able to sort of characterize different aspects of the regulations as effective, or compare food additives with drugs, with supplements, etc. And he's looked at all of the regulations and compared all of the provisions of the different types of food and drug and food additive regulations. And he has made it abundantly clear in a couple of very important documents, treatises, that the regulations covering dietary supplements are stronger than stronger than those required for food additives.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that nutrients and dietary supplement ingredients are inherently benign, and synthetic additives are inherently malign.
Right, they're foreign to the body.
Correct.
Saying that there are no instances of harm or adulteration or misdosing that occur in the supplement industry.
No.
You know, I recently talked to the head of the CRN, a guy named Steve Mister, who heads up
great,
that organization.
Very smart.
And
yeah.
He actually coined a very interesting phrase. He said, it's a tale of two industries.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have is we have responsible manufacturers, and we have renegades who try to fly under the radar, landish claims, products that are where there's poor quality control, or even potentially harmful, even drug ingredients in some cases. Like some of these male enhancement products, they may have, they may be spiked. They may be spiked with, Viagra-like compounds, so that you don't really know what you're getting.
And, correct.
So you know, the conundrum for the industry is, you know, how do we make sure that the good players don't get regulated out of existence, but how do we protect the public from the bad players?
There are some different efforts that are underway. One is a joint effort between CRN, the American Herbal Products Association, and Citizens for Health, about advertising, promoting the safe advertising, and giving consumers ways to kind of tell shady ads or shady products from legitimate products. The ads feature a silhouette of a sheriff from the Wild West and a gunslinger, and it is a new sheriff in town. And that sheriff really is a sheriff of self-regulation.
With the responsible members of the industry banding together under the banner of organizations like CRN, the Council for Responsible Nutrition, and self-policing, and urging members to do the right thing for the public.
That's correct. And, one of the things that we can do, and for example, I was an early voice in calling for the DEA to take over enforcement of spiked sports products, such as the Balco Labs products and other things like that. For several years, I was calling for the DEA to take over that, because they were dealing with products that are not dietary supplements. They were dealing with products that were masquerading as dietary supplements. Mm-hmm. They were, you know, literally drug hybrids that were intentionally adulterated and intentionally spiked. So since they're not supplements, and since we want to run them out of town, and we want to distance ourselves from those so consumers can make a better, more informed choice among a cleaner pool of products, you know, I and others have called for that, and recently, CRN and other organizations have taken up a call as well. That there are cases when, you know, having the DEA enforce against some of these products really might be a way of, because the DEA does not fool around.
No, indeed. So the call to action for our listeners, number one, get the book, Health at Gunpoint, the FDA's Silent War Against Health Freedom, the history of natural medicine in America, and also current challenges and threats to your health freedom. And what initiatives do you support? What would you tell listeners to do?
I think becoming, your listeners are well informed, but I would say becoming even better informed by visiting the websites of credible health advocacy organizations such as Citizens for Health, the Alliance for Natural Health.
Of which I'm a board member. You know, clearly I'm a proponent of that organization.
So that's excellent. And then the National Health Federation. Those are a few different organizations that have been around for a while and that provide good value, and equally importantly, they provide accurate information, and they provide platforms for informed action, where people can take action on different grassroots campaigns or writing their senators or writing the FDA or what have you. So it's not just learning about these what's going on, it's also people have an opportunity to take action.
So you said earlier you're not a Chicken Little, you know, the sky is falling, or the boy who cried wolf, but are you an optimist or a pessimist about what's coming down the pike for American consumers of health products?
Contrary to the very foreboding title and the gun on the cover of my book, I am actually an optimist. I'm pretty much a Pollyanna in certain ways. So I really do see it as a half glass full, a glass half full.
Right.
And so I have faith and hope and confidence in the American consumer. The American consumer is very smart and knows what he or she wants. If the American consumer is allowed to make informed choices and take informed actions regarding their health, then we're not going to have problems in America in terms of healthcare. It's when Americans are restricted from the products and the modalities that they know are good, that's when we have problems.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for a very informative interview. Once again, the book is Health at Gunpoint, and we'll post a link on our website to that as one of our recommended books. James Gormley, keep up the great work on behalf of consumers of natural health products.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine. You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce, and so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal, or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening, and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.